Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to episode 72 of Your Cases on Hold. We are in the middle of December, almost towards the holiday season and the new year. And we thank you for coming along on this three-year ride with us. And we're appreciative of all you who have been listening and faithfully listening all this time. My name is Antonia Chen. I'm deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction. And I have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods.
As a disclosure, again, all these opinions are our own, don't belong to anyone else, and are 100% ours and don't represent the JBJS board. That said, this episode is brought to you by JBJS CME. You need your CMEs, you need to go to JBJS CME. Everything there, all the information across all the board, not just one subspecialty area, but all different areas of orthopedics, and you won't be disappointed in what you'll see there. So starting us off here today, we're going from the top of the pile, adding surgical insult to myocardial injury after hip fracture by Pellegrini. It's permanently free. What's new in musculoskeletal tumor surgery by Gazandem, which is also permanently free. Evidence versus frenzy in robotic total knee arthroplasty, a systematic review comparing news media claims to randomized controlled trial evidence by Ektari et al. It's a visual summary and there's a commentary on it as well. What's important? Arts and Humanities, Legacy and Healing, the Art of Orthopedic Craftsmanship by Ganem, which is permanently free. What's important? Equitable orthopedic care for patients with disabilities by Lachandran, and it's also permanently free. And then Virtual Clinical Trials, Implications of Computer Simulations and Artificial Intelligence for Musculoskeletal Research by Mel, and In Appreciation 2024 for all those here at JBS.
And yeah, it's all the reviewers.
All the reviewers, right. Yeah. All the reviewers that you have. So if you've reviewed for JBJS, if you're currently reviewing for JBJS or reviewed in the past, this is a current shout out for those who have reviewed in 2024. So thank you for all those who are good reviewers and all the reviewers who have contributed. Do note that this is all by peer review process. So we thank you for what you've done and continue to do in making JBJS a great journal. Typical development of the secondary ossification centers of the acetabulum and their effects on acetabular coverage of the femoral head by Cho, and evaluating the ability of brachial plexus injured patients to control an externally powered myoelectric hand prosthesis by Lee, which seemed like a science fiction way of doing things in the past and now is actually coming to fruition, which is pretty cool. Levels of synovial fluid inflammatory biomarkers on day of arthroscopic partial meniscectomy predict long-term outcomes and conversion to total knee arthroplasty. A 10-year mean follow-up study by Moore et al. There's a commentary, there's infographic, and it's free for 30 days, so definitely worth reading. Dependable automated approach for measuring the retrograde superior ramus screw corridor in pelvic fracture fixation by Zhao et al. And without further ado, we're going to go to our headlines. Dr. Schoenfeld is going to talk about identifying risk factors for disease progression in development dysplasia of the hip using a contralateral hip model. Thank you for doing something a little different than spine. And we flipped flop this time, so you get to do a little bit of hip stuff. So thanks.
Yes, absolutely. You did a spine article last episode. So this is like developmental dysplasia of the hip. So it's kind of hip adjacent for your kind of total joint hip arthritis stuff, but certainly in that ballpark. So we know, of course, that developmental dysplasia can cause pain and accelerate precocious arthritis. Risk factors and timing for disease progression in adolescents and young adults have not been fully characterized. So this study was really seeking to determine the prevalence and risk factors of contralateral hip pain and surgery for individuals who underwent periacetabular osteotomy on a dysplastic hip. So they followed patients for at least 2 years, categorized into a contralateral pain or no pain groups, and whether or not they ended up having surgery or not on the other side. They do this, what we would call layered regression analysis, where they do initial, they call it univariate, but it really is bivariate testing, looking at differences in demographics, radiographic measures, range of motion, and then they do a multivariable analysis. And the multivariable model included risk factors that differed significantly between hips with and without contralateral pain or surgery in the initial testing, which for those regular listeners, you know, I don't really love that kind of approach. It can introduce artifacts in the model, especially in a context such as this. You know, they have 184 patients, which to some it's like, wow, that's, you know, so many. But we're talking about 93 reporting contralateral hip pain and 60 undergoing contralateral surgery. So that just limits clinical variation, creates potential truncations, artifacts in the model that may result from within the secondary effects and interactions, the presence of issues with power. But, you know, useful information as far as the findings go in terms of five-year survivorship, they have this at 49% with contralateral pain development as the endpoint and 66% with contralateral surgery as the endpoint. I think those are useful points to help patients and families understand expectations going forward. The acetabular inclination was the sole predictor of pain. They have an estimate for every 1 degree increase, which again is not likely to hold up especially well when extrapolated just based on the characteristics of the sample. But I do think that this is a point that is probably a testable item. So a little sneak peek into future testing questions probably. Surgically treated hips also had more severe dysplasia. That's probably not a surprise. Overall, you know, I think there are some issues with the way the authors went about this analysis. And there are some things that may not hold up in terms of translation and could be different in the hands of others or disparate clinical practices or different groups in terms of baseline demographics or baseline pathology. But I think, again, you know, some of this is very thoughtfully considered. They have good estimates regarding five-year survivorship, and that's probably going to be the most useful item that comes out of this in terms of clinical translation. And then there are some hidden testable points here as well.
Like Kaiser Sose hidden test or no?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that particularly with the, what's the main predictor of pain or inferior outcomes after this type of surgery, you know, reading this article, it's just sort of like, oh yeah, well, whatever it may be, but that definitely could sneak up on you again.
I completely agree. All right. Very interesting. I'm not sure this one's going to necessarily show up in little questions here, but it might. My one is on patient level value analysis and total hip arthroplasty, optimizing the value of care delivery by Doxy et al. And there's a commentary on this as well. So this is harking back to some good healthcare economics. What is value? Value is defined as the ratio of patient outcomes to the cost of care. So how valuable is a total hip replacement? There have been multitudes of studies looking at value, cost, and everything. And what the authors here said is we want to do something a little bit different. We want to look at patient-level value analysis, and they actually threw an extra one, which is provider-level value analysis. So one method to assess value utilizes patient-reported outcomes to represent patient outcomes, and the ratio is down to time-driven activity-based costing to estimate the cost of care. What is time-driven activity-based costing? It's a bottoms-up accounting approach that utilizes time as the primary metric for assigning value to the resources, specifically equipment and personnel that creates an individual service, thereby allowing for the identification of specific drivers of cost. So again, one method of assessing this value in episode of care is through patient-level value analysis, which is a patient-centered value measurement tool to identify patient and procedural characteristics that can potentially influence value on an episode of care. This is in contrast to provider level value analysis, which identifies physician characteristics that can affect value. So the purpose of the study was to assess, with the use of mostly the patient level value analysis, the value of 1 year episode of care among patients undergoing primary total hip arthroplasty. The primary outcome was 1 year value quotient, or the ratio of the 1 year change in the hip disability and osteoarthritis outcome score, also known as HOOS, JR, which is joint replacement, or the time-driven activity-based costing, estimated cost of care. The secondary outcome was this provider value quotient, which is determined by averaging the change in HOOS JR divided by the cost of care for cases performed by that particular surgeon. The patients here were patients who went under uncomplicated primary unilateral total hip arthroplasty between 2018 and 2019 using a patient-reported outcome measure database at a study institution. And they defined a lot of exclusion criteria that defined why they would choose a non-complicated total hip arthroplasty, understanding that a complicated total hip arthroplasty would definitely drive up costs and probably change the metric here. Again, the HoosJR was specifically used for patients. It was designed for patients undergoing total hip arthroplasty. So they used that metric. And the HoosJR data were collected preoperatively and at 1 year postoperatively. Cost was evaluated with the use of the TD-ABC for a one-year episode of care with an episode defined as a period from the date of surgery to 1 year postoperatively. And the cost of care using the TD-ABC methodology is equal to the sum of the direct and indirect costs within an episode of care. Of the 973 patients who underwent total hip arthroplasty during the study period, only 480 met the inclusion criteria. In this database study, there's a total of 11 surgeons with a mean case volume of 43 with a pretty big standard deviation of plus or minus 21. Of note, in other studies, you'll see that surgeons who have higher volume tend to have potentially better patient-reported outcomes and potentially lower costs. That is a slight confounding factor here with a low mean case volume within the 1 year that the study was being performed. The mean change in HoosJR was almost 35. The mean cost of care was $13,835. And the largest contributor to cost was implants at 39%, followed by post-recovery care, such as inpatient stays or SNFs at 24%. Costs were not surprisingly shown to differ by facility type. The mean cost of a total hip performed at an ASC, which is an ambulatory surgery center, was approximately $9,900. Whereas the mean cost of total hip arthroplasty performed at a hospital was around $15,000. The change in the HoosJR was poorly correlated with the total cost of care. Now, looking at multivariable analysis, older age, higher BMI, and female sex were predictive of higher costs, but ASA, or American Society of Anesthesiology scores, which is a determinant for healthiness of a patient of 1 or 2, were predictive of lower costs. The surgical characteristics that were predictive of higher overall costs, including the use of the hospital as a surgical facility versus an ASC, the use of dual mobility components versus standard components, multi-hole acetabular cups versus standard cups, and posterior approach versus anterior approach. Those that were predictive of lower costs included the use of spinal anesthesia versus general anesthesia, and the use of cobalt chromium or actinium zirconium femoral head versus ceramic head. Not surprisingly, total hip arthroplasties performed in an ASC with discharge to home were associated with higher value than total hips performed at a hospital with a discharge to a SNF because the costs were different. There's also potential differences in patient-reported outcomes. There were significant differences in cost and the change in the HoosJR between surgeons who provided the highest value care, meaning lower cost, and surgeons who performed the lowest value care, which had higher costs. Interestingly enough, both of these surgeons had a fellowship in adult reconstruction. But that said, the authors found that lacking additional fellowship training was shown to be associated with lower value care delivery. Surgeons who performed greater than 50% of their cases at an ASC also demonstrated a lower cost of care. So in conclusion, we can improve patient outcomes or decrease costs to improve value, which were mostly driven by implant types, so not using dual mobility, not using multi-hole cups, which are more expensive. Surgical approach, interestingly enough, posterior was more cost-effective or more value than anterior approach, and that could be due to time and operative time. Surgical facility and ASC will be cheaper than inpatient hospital stay, especially if a patient goes home right away, and then discharge location, home versus a SNF. With regards to surgeons, fellowship training was associated with higher care delivery, so potentially having joint replacement surgeons or at least adopting the care pathways that high volume surgeons typically utilize. It's not a life-shattering article, but it's interesting to see what increases value specifically in the realm of total hip arthroplasty. I don't think a lot of the information was new, but the methodology may be interesting that others might want to use in their articles.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest concern here is really just based on the fact that it's essentially single practice or single center data in some respect. It's not exactly single center because you have the hospital versus the ASC, but there's going to be a certain selection and indication bias that are factored into that, as well as who's getting what type of approaches and who's getting what types of anesthesia. So 480 patients is a reasonable number of patients for health policy work. It's not that many. It's very hard to do high-level health policy work where you're going to have the patient-reported outcome measures. Just based on the nature through which that type of data is collected. As you said, a lot of the findings are somewhat intuitive. I'm not sure that this is especially translatable just based on the risk for selection indication bias and those associations with cost. I mean, ASC is always going to be less expensive than the hospital. Also, the patients who require less medical care by definition are going to get the ASC versus you're not going to have like a high acuity, high healthcare cost utilization patient getting ASC. They're going to be in the hospital for the surgery.
Right. So I completely agree with you. Not life-shattering, kind of confirms what we typically know already. All right, moving on. Myocardial injury in patients with hip fracture, a hip attack randomized trial sub-study. I will say, as titles go, I love saying hip attack. This is Borges et al. Hip attack. I mean, well-named, very well-named. Borges et al. Is 30 days free. There's a visual summary and there's a commentary. So the most common perioperative complication associated with the hip fracture is myocardial injury, which is seen at least 20% of patients at hospital presentation. And so the authors here conducted a study called the hip attack, which is a previous study that looked, that randomized 2,970 patients with a hip fracture to undergo accelerated surgery, meaning within 6 hours of arriving or 6 hours of the orthopedic diagnosis, they underwent surgery, or standard care was a median of 24 hours from orthopedic diagnosis. And what they wanted to see is if patients with hip fracture and myocardial injury may benefit from accelerated surgery to remove the psychological stress associated with the hip fracture. It was a comparison of 90-day risk of death in patients with hip fracture who presented with an elevated cardiac biomarker / enzyme measurement at hospital arrival. And this is specifically ended up being troponin because 99.9% of them were troponin. So what happened is in the original study, they took all the patients and say early versus standard surgery, is there a difference in outcomes? Here they took patients who specifically at elevated troponin and see if they had a difference in outcomes. And so the previous one didn't specifically look at MI patients or patients with elevated troponin. They were originally from 69 centers in 17 countries, so a very cool international study. In the patients with just MI, it went down to 61 centers. It was a randomized controlled trial designed to determine whether accelerated surgery for hip fracture was superior to standard of care to reduce death or major complications. In this study, the primary outcome was also all-cause mortality. Secondary outcomes included a composite of major perioperative vascular complications like all-cause mortality and non-fatal MI, congestive failure, and stroke. The main exclusion criteria were the use of therapeutic anticoagulants with no reversing drug available, periprosthetic fracture, and high-energy fracture. 23% of patients had troponin elevation at hospital arrival. Patients with and without a baseline troponin elevation had similar histories of myocardial infarction, stable angina, coronary artery vascularization, and aortic valve stenosis. And these baseline characteristics were also similar to the overall hip attack trial population. For the patients with a troponin elevation, the mean time from hip fracture diagnosis to surgery was 6 hours in the accelerated surgery group and 29 hours in the standard care group, which is very similar to the one that didn't have elevated troponin. Patients with an increased baseline troponin level had a lower risk of mortality with accelerated surgery compared with standard care, whereas patients with no elevated troponin level demonstrated no mortality reduction with accelerated surgery. Among patients with an elevated troponin level, the risk of secondary composite outcomes of major perioperative cardiovascular complications was lower in the accelerated surgery group compared to standard care group, and patients with no elevated troponin levels, like the previous statement, demonstrated no reduction in the composite outcome with accelerated surgery. Interestingly enough, accelerated surgery lowered the mortality risk in patients with greater than 2.1 times troponin elevation more than it did in patients with less or no troponin elevation. An elevated baseline troponin level is independently associated with 90-day mortality when adjusted for age, sex, cardiovascular risk factors, other clinically important comorbidities, and the treatment effect. In multivariable analysis, accelerated surgery was associated with lower all-cause mortality compared with standard care. So it's a very interesting conclusion to me, at least. In my mind, if you're actively having an MI, undergoing surgery can stress your system out more, so more likely to have a higher mortality and more likely to have secondary complications. And this large multi-center study in this patient population with elevated troponins, it showed the complete opposite. Accelerated surgery had lower mortality risk than standard care for these patients. So even if a patient is having an active medical problem, the authors purport that you can go ahead and operate on them because the patient will end up having a better outcome than if you wait the standard 24 hours. So it is actually, I think, a good use of a large prospective study with a different subset of patients that had an interesting finding. So this is not on hold by me.
Yeah, no, not on hold at all. Typically you'll see these kinds of studies where it's a randomized trial and then they'll do a secondary analysis or sub-analysis, which sort of becomes like this opportunistic, essentially retrospective study of prospective data collected as part of an RCT. They were careful to say in the methods that they determine a priori, the primary outcome, and it seems like they probably did have adequate numbers with the 322 patients, 23% of the total population of 1,392 patients. But they are, engaging in testing of interactions and sometimes, again, 320-something patients seems like a lot. But once you start getting into various combinations of secondary factors and age with BMI, with comorbidities, with those cells get smaller and smaller. So that's just something for the interested reader to be aware of. But overall, I agree with your assessment. Very interesting study. This is the work that was commented on by Dr. Pellegrini in the top of the pile, the first article in the top of the pile section. So hopefully useful in practice and interesting for those to read as well in your comfortable chair by the fireside in this season of warmth and looking forward to future prospects as 2025 comes upon us.
I like future prospects. That's a good thing. All right. Continuing in our honorable mentions, dual mobility articulations and revision total hip arthroplasty, a comparison with metal or ceramic on highly cross-linked polyethylene and constrained articulations by Katode et al. With a commentary. In this study of 375 United States adult patients who underwent primary total hip arthroplasty and went on to undergo an aseptic revision total hip arthroplasty from 2002 to 2022, when dual mobility acetabular constructs were used, they were found to have the lowest re-revision risk and lowest dislocation risk. Both outcomes of re-revision and dislocation were significantly lower than those using a unipolar femoral head on cross-linked polyethylene, and re-revision risk was significantly lower than using a constrained liner, and dislocation risk trended towards a lower risk than using a constrained liner. Next, a computer modeling-based target zone for transposition osteotomy of the acetabulum in patients with hip dysplasia by Kitamura et al. Acetabular reorientation to a lateral center edge angle of between 30 and 35 degrees with an additional 15 degrees of anterior rotation may serve as a biomechanics-based target zone for surgeons performing transposition osteotomy of the acetabulum in most patients with hip dysplasia. However, patients with a reduced preoperative head-neck offset ratio at the 130 clock position may experience limited range of motion and activities of daily living postoperatively. And finally, management of dorsal bunion in non-ambulatory adolescents with cerebral palsy, a retrospective cohort study by Vandeveld, which is permanently free. The surgical correction of a dorsal bunion via soft tissue rebalancing of the first ray and corrective arthrodesis of the first metatarsophalangeal joint resulted in favorable midterm clinical and radiographic outcomes in non-ambulatory adolescents with cerebral palsy. So go ahead and fix them. There's actually a benefit to your patient, even though they're not ambulatory. Thanks for being with us. Truly appreciate it. It's always a phenomenal time to talk about some interesting articles, and we definitely got a lot of them today. So until next time.
In 2025, our next time will be in 2025 as we start year four of Your Case is on Hold. Thanks to those who have been on this journey with us since the beginning, and hopefully those who are coming in midstream. You'll check out back issues, see what we had to say on previous articles, both this year and in years past, as we look forward toward the year to come.